Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 80 countries around the world over the Internet. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events, so stay tuned for tonight's special report on the Kwok-Ting test when we come back. You know, over the past century, we Americans who were once independent, capable, and able to manage our own financial, medical, and legal affairs have now been reduced to dependence, to incompetence, incapacity. We've now been made wards of powerful commercial, financial, medical, and legal corporations, cartels, and bureaucratic institutions of our modern industrial society. And we've been taught to rely upon these paid professionals. Professionals like bankers to manage our financial affairs and doctors to manage and treat our health problems and lawyers to direct our business and legal affairs instead of relying upon our own good common sense. That's why I contend that it's time that we Americans who were once able to catch our own fish learn once again how to fish instead of being fed by these paid professionals. Regaining our power of attorney is the single most important step in regaining our capacity, our rights, our liberties, and our duties. Now, if you'd like to learn more about courtroom strategy and procedure, write for my free general law CD package. That's the place to start. It's an educational, informative, and entertaining series of CDs. Best of all, that's free of charge, and you can call and order one right now. The number to call, 417-273-4967. Once more, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, if you're online, you can go to our website and send us an email. It's georgegordon.org. Just click onto the email machine and send us an email request. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or call us direct at 417-273-4967. Do it right now before you forget. Well, who is the best person that you know of to represent you or to cross-examine an adverse witness? I'm asked that a lot of times, and my conclusion is that you are. If you're a defendant, or whether you're a professional, you can be a lawyer, you know, if you want. But the lawyer only knows as much as you tell him. And that's why my conclusion's always been that if you're there and you saw the events and you know who's lying and you know who isn't lying, you know who's telling the truth, well then, you're the person who is most likely to be able to trip up a perjured witness. Now, it isn't that the lawyer can't do it. It's that the lawyer, when he comes into the case, is at a distinct disadvantage compared to the defendant or the plaintiff who was actually there. Now, we'll take a look at some of those kinds of cases. Let's take a look at one right here, the professional witness. The professional witness. And then ask yourself, well, could I have done that? Could O.J. Simpson do what his legal team did for him had he known how to do the examination? Could he have done the same F. Lee Bailey examination of Mark Furman that F. Lee Bailey did? Well, my contention would be yes, and even better. Because O.J. was either there or he wasn't there. And when somebody tells a story, and you know that it's a manifest lie, your lawyer doesn't know that that's a lie. And he may believe the guy that's telling the lie more than he believes you. Now, here's a neat story. The professional witness is always partisan, and he's always ready and eager to serve the party that's calling him. This fact should be ever present in the mind of the cross-examiner. So encourage the witness to betray his partisanship. encourage him to volunteer statements and opinions, and to give unresponsive answers. Jurors are always looking with suspicion upon such testimony. Assume that an expert witness is called against you has come prepared to do you all the harm that he can, and he will avail himself of every opportunity to do so, which you may inadvertently give him these opportunities. Such witnesses are usually shrewd and cunning men, and they come into court well prepared on the subject concerning that which they are to testify. Some experts, however, are mere shams and pretenders. Now, I remember witnessing many years ago the total collapse of one of these expert pretenders of the medical type. It was in a damage suit against the city, which I defended, and the plaintiff's doctor was a loquacious gentleman of considerable personal presence. He testified to a serious head injury and then proceeded to lecture the jury on the subject in a sensational and oracular manner which evidently made a great impression upon them. Even the judge seemed to give more than the usual attention. The doctor talked glibly about vasomotor nerves and reflexes, and he expressed himself almost entirely in medical terms, which the jury didn't understand. Then he polished off his testimony with the prediction that the plaintiff could never recover, and if he lived at all, it would necessarily be within the precincts of an insane asylum. Now, I saw at a glance that this was no ordinary type of witness, and my conclusion was that any cross-examination on the medical side of this case would be sure to fail, because the witness, though evidently dishonest, was yet very ingenious, and he was ingenious enough to cover his tracks by the cuttlefish expedients of befogging his answers in a cloud of medical terms. So Dr. Alan McLean Hamilton, who was present as medical advisor in behalf of the city, suggested an expedient which I adopted, and here's what we did. I said, counsel, I said, doctor, I infer from the number of books that you have brought here to substantiate your position, and from your manner of testifying, that you're very familiar with the literature of your profession, and especially that part relating to head injury. And the doctor said, well, I pride myself that I am, and I have not only a large private library, but I have spent many months in the libraries of Vienna, Berlin, Paris, and London. Counsel. Then perhaps you are acquainted with Andrew's celebrated work on the recent and remote effects of head injury. And the doctor smiled superciliously, and he said, well, I should say I was. Why, I had occasion to consult it only last week. Counsel. Well, have you ever come across Charvis on cerebral trauma, doctor? Well, yes, I have. I've read Dr. Charvis's book from cover to cover many times. Counsel continued in much the same strain, putting to the witness similar questions relating to many other fictitious medical works, all of which the good doctor had either studied carefully or he had in his library and was about to read them. Until finally, suspecting that the doctor was becoming conscious of the trap into which he was being led, counsel suddenly changed his tactics and then demanded in a loud, sneering tone if the doctor had ever read Page on injuries of the spine and spinal cord. Now, that book is a genuine and a most learned treatise on the subject. But to this inquiry, the doctor laughingly replied, I've never even heard of any such book, and I guess you never did either. Well, now the climax had been reached. Dr. Hamilton was immediately sworn for the defense, and he explained to the jury his participation in preparing the list of bogus medical works with which this learned expert for the plaintiff had shown such familiarity. On the other hand, when the cross-examiner has totally failed to shake the testimony of an able and honest expert, he should be very wary of attempting to discredit him by any slurring allusions to his professional ability, as it will, or as well illustrated by the following example of the danger of giving the expert a good chance for a retort. Now, Dr. Joseph Collins, he was a well-known nerve specialist. He was giving testimony recently on the side of the Metropolitan Street Railway in a case where the plaintiff claimed to be suffering from a misplaced kidney, which the railroad doctors examined. In their examination, they failed to disclose. Now, having made nothing out of the cross-examination of Dr. Collins, the plaintiff's lawyer threw this parting boomerang at the witness. He said, "After all, doctor, isn't it a fact that nobody in your profession regards you as a surgeon?" "Doctor, I never regarded myself as a surgeon." "Counsel, you're a neurologist, aren't you, doctor?" And the doctor said, "Yes, I am." "Counsel, a neurologist, pure and simple." The doctor, "Well, I am moderately pure and altogether simple." Now, I point these two out, one after the other, for our consideration here, because remember, the Kwok-Ting test is designed to show the liar. We're trying to expose the perjured testimony. In the case of this doctor here that we just read about, he comes in and he says in his testimony that this guy is injured and this guy is never going to recover. He's got these spinal injuries. Now remember, this very same guy has been inspected. He's been looked over by the other side's doctors. And they take a look at him, and you know, people get to be partisans based upon which side that they're on. A witness ought not to be a partisan. The witness is simply there to tell what he knows, what he saw, what he heard. He's not there trying to win the case for one side or the other. But now, that's where the perfect world comes in. That's what he's supposed to do. The truth of the matter is, the witness, no matter who he's called for, he sees himself as an advocate for that side. So, if you're being called for the prosecution, then you're opposed to the defense. And if you're called as a defense witness, then you're opposed to the prosecution. You see yourself as being on that side, because that's the side you're being called for. That's the side you're pulling for. That's the side you're rooting for. The reality of it is what difference does it make to us one way or the other how the case comes out? As a witness, my job is to testify as to what I heard, what I saw, and what I know. But that's not the way we behave. And you can see that here with this doctor. Now see, he probably has a financial interest involved. The doctor who's attending to the plaintiff in this case. And as a result of that, he may be getting a portion of the proceeds from his testimony. Now, normally an expert witness gets paid about $600 for a one-day appearance. You know, you call him in, he testifies, and you pay him $600 and he's out of it. A lawyer, on the other hand, is typically getting paid a portion of the winnings. That is, if we win a $1 million judgment, I get a third of it. So he's not just working for $10,000 or $15,000 to do the case. He's actually working for a portion of what he wins. Sometimes the witness is getting paid a portion based upon the win. It's not supposed to be that way, but then that's sometimes the way it is. So when this guy comes in, you know, he's out to do you all the harm that he can. He's a partisan. He's been hired for that side. And for that reason, since he's getting paid $600 to express his opinion, remember, an opinion now isn't objective. It's totally biased. So in order to impeach this guy, it doesn't mean that every time that you do this, the guy's going to fall for the bait, or he's going to take the bait and fall into the trap. But keep in mind that we have 23 techniques that we can use. I mean, we're not limited to just one or two. We've got 23. And this is just one of them. All right, now with that in mind, let's take a look at this partisan thing again from the point of view of a ship. This is called the fireboat story. And that's on page 57 here. So let's flip over here to page 57. And then it deals with the thing called partisanship. And how do you overcome this partisanship? How do you expose it for the jury? And oftentimes, you know, if you can show the jury or if you can show the judge, hey, these guys are just manifest partisans. You know, they've got a vested interest in this deal. These are not ordinary witnesses. And these witnesses are exaggerating the facts. They're not telling the whole truth. Or they're telling the truth. But the emphasis that they're putting on the truth that they're telling, they're not telling all of the story. There's some of the story that they're leaving out, or they're adding to the story things that never occurred. That didn't happen that way. Now, we see perhaps the most marked instances of partisanship in the Admiralty cases, which arise out of a collision between two ships. And almost invariably, all of the crew on one ship will testify in unison against the opposing crew. And what is even more significant, such passengers as happen to be on either ship will almost invariably be found corroborating the stories of their respective crews. Now, Mr. Joseph H. Choate, Jr. had an amazing experience in one of his Admiralty cases, which illustrates the proper way to handle such a situation. The city of New York had sued the New Haven Railroad for damages growing out of a collision between boats owned by the respective parties. Now, the city's fireboat, the New Yorker, had been run down as it was backing out of its slip by a car float, which one of the New Haven's tugs had been most improperly towing through the North River, too close to the pier ends. There was no possible denial of the tug's fault, and the defense had no evidence of any possible fault on the part of the fireboat. Though it was hard to see how the collision could have occurred if the fireboat had been keeping a proper lookout. As usual, the crew were called as witnesses, each in succession. Now, the first witness on the fireboat, the City of New Yorker, testified that he had been properly posted as a lookout and had acted accordingly. Now, this statement proved unshakable on cross-examination, and the situation looked very bleak. But with the next witness, however, the cross-examiner decided to see whether the well-known tendency of crew witnesses to become advocates for their vessel might not be used to produce some proof in support of his belief that in spite of the first witness's testimony, there had been negligence in the keeping of the required lookout. So he, accordingly, asked a number of questions as to just what the witness had been doing during the seconds preceding the impact. These questions were purposely framed so as to suggest that counsel thought that the witness had been asleep or otherwise negligent in his duties as a lookout. Then the witness, annoyed by this question, "Were you looking out for possible danger?" brought about an immediate and emphatic, "Yes, I was looking out for danger." A contemptuous, "Well, what business was that of yours?" Well, this led the witness to reply that he had been told to keep a lookout also. Then a final question as to who had given him this order established him as a second, entirely regular lookout who had been doing his duty. Now, he used the same tactics, produced the same result with each succeeding member of the crew of nine. each one of the crew members jumping at the chance of defending his ship and his own vigilance at the same time, and he placed himself as an officially posted lookout. This left the fireboat, the City of New Yorker, setting upon its voyage with 9 lookouts, which then raised the question, well, who's operating the ship? And it left the vessel in the ridiculous position of starting its voyage with 9 specially detailed lookouts. This was too much for the presiding judge, who either concluded that he could not believe any of the lookouts, or that the divided responsibility had ruined the efficiency of all of the members of the crew, and accordingly held the New Yorker also in fault and divided the damages. Each side pays their own. Now, you know, I've over the years accumulated a number of stories, and I've observed a number of these stories. For instance, back in 1956, a ship called the Andrea Doria was struck amidship by the liner, the Stockholm. Well, Ruth Roman was a movie actress, and she was riding on the Andrea Doria. And when she got off, they were rescued at sea, see, and then they were brought into New York. And when she got off the ship, she gave a statement to the press, and she said, yeah, you know, everything was going fine until those dirty guys on the Stockholm ran into our ship and sank us. And I remember as a teenager at the time, I said, you know, well, how does she know? Because at the time, there was a question in the paper. I was a paper boy at the time. And so there was a question that came up as to whether or not the Stockholm was at fault for ramming the Andrea Doria, or the Andrea Doria was at fault for running in front of the Stockholm. In other words, it was in the wrong place at the wrong time because they weren't following the rules of the road. Well, as it turned out, after the investigation was over, it was the Andrea Doria that was at fault. It wasn't the Stockholm. But it was the Stockholm that rammed the Andrea Doria, and the Andrea Doria sank, and so therefore, you know, at first blush, you'd say, well, why did you run into that ship? Well, because I was on my course and I was doing the right things, and these guys were supposed to stay out of my path, and they ran right in front of me. Now, it was in the fog, and they couldn't see each other in the fog, but they had radar, and they were supposed to be using their radars, both ships, and each ship was supposed to take evasive action when they saw each other. Now, each ship, you know, steers to the left. And so if they'd have both done that, well, there wouldn't have been a problem. But the Andrea Doria steered in the wrong direction. And Ruth Roman, when she came off, she was a partisan. She was a passenger on the Andrea Doria, and so she was blaming the Stockholm. She didn't know one way or the other. Her testimony should have been when the newspaper reporter said, well, what happened, Miss Roman? And instead of saying, I don't know. I was asleep in my stateroom. I don't know. I was having dinner. I didn't see anything. Now, I remember a little earlier I pointed out that as an observer, riding in the front of Earl Sherman's car, I made an observation, and my observation was totally in error. And like Ruth Roman, I was a partisan. I was a partisan for my boss, Earl Sherman. And I would have testified for him. Furthermore, it looked like to me that the Delta truck hit our car. But as we discussed that one at some length earlier, that wasn't the case. Now, this thing of the partisan over here, whether it's a doctor testifying as an expert witness, as we've seen, I'll show you another one next time, about Dr. Erickson on the spine. And we'll take a look at this partisanship. We'll take a look at these expert witnesses. An expert witness is not to be believed. He's not to be trusted any more than anybody else. In fact, he should be a suspect because he's getting paid a fee. He is a partisan. So tuck that one away in your heart. Now, that's not to say that you shouldn't hire an expert witness, because if the other side is going to bring in an expert, you have to bring in an expert to counter that expert. And failure to do so is almost, tantamount to giving up and losing to the other side. All right, so let's take a look now at another section over here, another technique over here that we can use. It's called humor. And humor is a very, very subtle, very powerful tool to be used against your opponent. Now, not everybody can do this, and I'm not suggesting that they can, but, you know, if, you know, the circumstances warrant, and if, you know, you can use humor, you ought to do it. I remember one time my wife, she's kind of humorous. She had a guy call one time here on the telephone. The guy wanted to talk to me, and sometimes, you know, people call. And if my wife is gone and I'm the only guy here and I hear the telephone, you know, sometimes I pick it up. It's not too often, but once in a while. And people are sometimes surprised and they say, "Oh, is this Mr. Gordon?" "Yep, you got me live and direct. You know, what can I do for you?" Well, they'll be calling and they want a CD set, or they'll call. And then all of a sudden, you know, "Well, I've got you on the telephone, so let me ask you these questions." And oftentimes, you know, if I'm sitting there eating lunch or something, you know, I'll say, "Well, go ahead, let me see if I know the answer." Sometimes people call and they say that they want me to answer their questions, and I say, "Well, now that presumes an awful lot, doesn't it? I mean, when you ask me a question, you're presuming I know the answer. What makes you think I know the answer? But you go ahead and ask anyway, and if I know, I'll tell you, and if I don't know, I'll tell you that too." You know, oftentimes I tell people, I don't know. And I think that kind of shocks them more than anything. They go, "My God, you don't know?" Now, I told you a little humorous story about Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes. Listen up again. Let's learn a lesson. Holmes is asked by his clerk, "Mr. Chief Justice, how much law do you know?" And the Chief Justice, his response was, "I don't know very much law." And as a result of that, the clerk was shocked, and he said, "Well, my God, you're the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. We would expect you to know all the law that there is to know." And the Chief Justice responded, he said, "No, I really don't know a whole lot. But," he said, "I'm God-awful good at the little bit that I do know." And that reminded me of a little story that came from Kent Hovind. One time he's been asked by a skeptic, you know, sometimes you run across these skeptics, you know, they say, "Hey, you must be pretty dumb." And the humorous response, I like to call it the logical response, because logic is such a powerful tool, and logic is really akin to humor. And so anyway, this guy asked Kent Hovind, he said, he was ridiculing, made fun of him. He said, "You really don't believe that, do you? You're trying to get us to believe this." And so Hovind made this observation. He said, "Sir, do you know everything that there is to know in the world?" And so, you know, the guy said, no, I don't know everything." And Hovind said, "Well, do you know half of everything that there is to know in the whole wide world?" And the guy said, "Well, no, probably I don't know half." And then Hovind asked the closing question and said, "Could it be, sir, that what I'm telling you is a part of that one half of everything in the world that there is to know that you haven't heard yet?" All right, now there's a little humor, and there's logic that goes with it. And the logic is the humor behind it. Nobody in his right mind would say, "I know everything that there is to know in the world." Nobody would even go so far as to say, "I know half of everything there is to know in the world." Or a fourth. Or a tenth, for that matter. And could it be that maybe what I'm telling you is something that you've never heard before? But that doesn't necessarily mean that it isn't true. Again, here's humor coming to the fore. And so humor can work both ways. You can have a witness on the witness stand who can use humor to discredit or to score points on the examiner. Or the examiner can use humor, and he can score points on the witness. And humor works back and forth. And I kind of like humor because humor, to me, is the manifestation of the logic. I like the, well, sir, why don't you tell the jury how it is that there's 167 Democratic votes that you counted, and here were 12 witnesses that came in and testified they voted the straight Republican ticket, and theirs weren't counted. And then you can just take your hat and walk right out of this courtroom. See, there's an element of humor in that. And that humor is important because it's fundamental to logic. It's just fundamental to, oh, yeah. Or like the little boy, well, now, son, can you tell us how it is that you were late for school or you were worried about being late on December 28th, which was during vacation? Oh, yeah. And when this is sprung, it's the closing question. And when the witness can't answer, the humor manifests itself. Oh, yeah. The logic of it. See how simple that is? All right, we're talking about the Kwok Ching test. What we're trying to do here is uncover the truth. Now we're at the halfway point. Let me give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Remember, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. Now, if you'd like more information about the law school and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, that's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, then please go to our homeschooling page on the website. The Law Hour is updated weekly. The website is updated weekly. And it has our radio log, our schedule, and our archives, and that can be accessed through the website as well. Now, the Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date. That's for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Now, the Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. Now, the law school offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the law school at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, news, and current events, and we do that 7 days a week. The sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and Editorial Review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. We often endorse and recommend books, periodicals, papers, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements are recommendations that we give. They don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse and recommend are necessarily going to reciprocate. And most of these authors and publications that we cite here on the Law Hour may be political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans whose viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and Editorial Review. These opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of the advertisers, the sponsors, the management, or the staff of this network or of this local radio station. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. I should remind you that this case, Kwok Ting, this is called the Kwok Ting test. If you want to look it up, it's cited at 140 in the U.S., 417. That's 140 of the U.S. Supreme Court reports. It's called 140 U.S., page 417. It's just a two-page treatise here on the Kwok Ting test. Now, the key to understanding all of this and putting it all together is called the Art of Cross-Examination. I've just brought out maybe 10 or 15 stories here out of the book. The book's about 500 pages, in which Francis Wellman has gleaned from the historical records on cross-examination. I'd say probably a couple of hundred. I'd say, I'm just guessing, 200, maybe 150 of these stories. I'm going to relate to you 10 or 15 of my favorites. The guy's name is Francis Wellman, and the book is called The Art of Cross-Examination. Now, the art of cross-examination is the standard in all law schools. Every student in America, every law student in America gets trained out of Wellman. There's other books, but, that's the number one book. And that's because it's got so many of these good stories in it. And Wellman is the guy that developed these 23 techniques. And there's 23 ways for you to impeach the testimony of a perjured witness. And that's why I've said, if they're telling the truth about you, they got you. But if they're lying about you, then we can expose that. And so we're exploring some of these techniques. Now, in the use of humor, there's a couple of more stories over here that I wanted to point out. From the book of Proverbs, there's a proverb that says, pride goes before a fall. Pride goes before a fall. And so, in the case of that story, that I just told you, the guy's pride, this doctor, who's trying to impress us all by all of these books that he's read. So the examiner wants to show that this guy is a manifest liar, that he's exaggerating. And people resent being lied to. When you expose that lie immediately, then they get upset about that. Now remember, we're all liars. I was asked that question by the Ninth Circuit one day. We were in court over the oath issue, and the judge, he said, "I see here in your brief that you're a pathological liar, Mr. Gordon." And I said, "Yes, sir." And he said, "Is that the truth?" Now think about that. There's a little element of humor there. And the judge asked me the question. He says, "I see here in your brief, Mr. Gordon, that you claim that you are a pathological liar." And then I answered the question, "Yes, sir." Now he turns around and he said, "Well, Mr. Gordon, is that the truth?" That's the closing question. And I said, "Yes, sir, that's the truth. I am a pathological liar." He said, "Well, then how can we believe you?" And I said, "You can't." And that's the truth. And the Bible tells us that all men are, let God be found true, or let God be true, though every man be found a liar. And I pointed out the Professor Swift experiment, in which 25% of that which we tell people is false. This is why the scripture says, swear not at all. You can't swear because you can't tell the truth. You may think you know the truth. You may actually believe that it's the truth. I pointed out to you earlier that 30% of the men who are in prison who have been accused by women that said, "That was the guy that raped me," 30% of them are false. It's not true. They did not rape those women. And we know that. We've documented, tested. And so as a result of that, when the judge asked me Mr. Gordon, is that the truth? There was an element of humor, and the judge was looking for, well, who's telling the truth here? And so I told him the truth. I said, yes, sir, it's true that I'm a liar. Well, how can we believe you? I said, you can't. So the scripture says, well, let your yea be yea and your nay be nay. I will relate to you the facts as I remember them. I will tell you what it is that I know. Here's what I heard. But without drawing any conclusions, I'll leave it up to you to decide, well, who's telling the truth? Well, when it was all said and done, the judges came together and they said, well, we think this guy Gordon is probably telling the truth. Yeah, it is. He's a pathological liar. But you see, here's what this does to all of us. It says that we're all liars. And, you know, we don't like that. We don't like to admit that we're liars. We want everybody to believe that we're honest and telling the truth. And that's what tripped up this doctor here, you know. They said, well, did you read this book? Oh, yeah, I read that book. Well, how about this book? Oh, I just read it this morning. Well, how about this book over here? I've got two of them in the library. It's such a good book, I got two of them. Then he shifts his technique and he comes back and he says, well, I suppose you'd claim that you heard about this book over here. And the guy now suspecting, oh, well, you know, that's probably a phony book. Remember, one of the techniques that we're developing here is the answer that we want is the opposite. So we need to learn how to ask questions. Can you learn how to ask questions? And the answer is, well, you bet you can. Sure you can. Now here's a humorous story. Now listen to the self-deprecating. Oftentimes when you, instead of trying to boast about yourself or boost yourself, you turn around and you say, well, I'm just a lowly mason here, and there's a story here about Giuseppe the mason. And what's so good about the story is that it's self-deprecating. In a recent case, an Italian contractor was suing to recover for building a masonry wall for a garage, which he alleged was in all respects built in a good and workmanlike manner. The claim of the defense was that the wall was poorly built and not in accord with proper masonry standards. So in support of this defense, the cross-examiner was trying to show that the plaintiff's employees, Italian masons, were an inferior grade of workmen and knew little of the jobs required of them. Question. Was Domenico a good mason? Oh, yes, a very fine mason. And Giuseppe, was he a good mason? Answer. Even better. Question. How about Giovanni? Answer. Best of the three. Then the examiner said, with a disrespectful tone, well, I suppose then that you claim all masons are good masons. Answer. No, just alike a lawyers. Some a gooda, some a rotten. All right, now here's a case, think about this one. Here's a case where the Italian mason, in his own defense, is on the witness stand. His opponent is the lawyer. He's trying to collect. Evidently, the customer refused to pay him. And so the customer, if he doesn't pay, naturally, he's got to have a reason why. You hired this guy, how come you didn't pay him? Well, because he did a bad job. Well, the bad job is subjective. Who said it was a bad job? So oftentimes what we try to do is to justify our position. Maybe the guy did do a bad job. Maybe he's not entitled to full payment, but maybe he's entitled to half. Maybe he's entitled to two-thirds. And then maybe, well, if you'd come in here and fix the mistake, I'd pay you the whole thing. But no, the guy didn't pay him. And so here comes the Italian mason. Now, both sides now are partisans, aren't they? And so the Italian Mason, he uses humor over here to illustrate a point. I suppose you're going to claim that all Masons are good Masons. Well, obviously, some Masons are going to be better than others. You know, some lawyers are better than others. Jerry Spence is better than the average. F. Lee Bailey is better than the average. Johnny Cochran was better than the average. That doesn't mean that all lawyers are equal. Doesn't mean that all Masons are equal. All plumbers are equal. But then it doesn't mean that the Mason isn't a Mason, that he doesn't do respectable work, or that the lawyer isn't a fair to middling lawyer. He may not be a crackerjack lawyer, but he may be fair to middling. He may be average. So in any profession, you know, stop and think about it for a minute. Everybody in every profession has a certain level of skill and ability. Nobody is the best. Nobody is the worst. Everybody fits somewhere in between. Now, there's got to be a best and there's got to be a worst, but you don't know who that is. You know, as bad as the guy is that did your work, there's got to be somebody worse than him. In theory, there's a worst, and in theory, there's the best, but the reality of it is everybody is out here in between somewhere. I don't claim to be the best, nor do I admit to being the worst. I'm somewhere in between. And people complain about me and they say, well, you know, you're not good enough. You're not the best. And so maybe one guy, he hires somebody that's better than me, and then the guy that hired me says, oh, I should have hired that other guy because that Gordon wasn't the best. All right, but there's four ways to do the job. And I'll concede that my way of doing the job is the most expensive. It is the slowest and the least efficient. But, hey, it gets the job done. It'll accomplish the goal. Now, another guy comes along, and he's the fastest. He's the best. And he's the cheapest. And his is the most efficient. Well, okay. Compared to what? Well, compared to me. But if you compared that guy to a Jerry Spence, you know, he'd fall on his face by comparison. So everybody likes to compare what they got with somebody better and then complain about how bad their contractor was, or their lawyer was, or their doctor was. Now, there's certainly incompetence out there. I don't deny that. And when that's found, it ought to be exposed. And humor, oftentimes, is the way to do it. Listen to this one. In another case, a fire insurance company was being sued by a merchant for the loss of a stock of caviar. The merchant, the principal witness in his own behalf, was attempting to enhance the value and the quality of his merchandise as much as possible without too close of an approach to downright perjury. So he gave testimony to the effect that practically all of the caviar in the burned warehouse was Russian, an Astrakhan Beluga, most excellent and expensive brand of sturgeon caviar. Now the cross-examiner thought he saw an opportunity to exhibit to the jury the ignorance of the witness as well as his own perjury. Now, question. Is it not a fact that all of your caviar in the warehouse was what is known as whitefish caviar, which is a poor and inferior type of article, not even a true caviar? Answer. No, sir. None of it. Question. How do you know it wasn't? Do you even know where whitefish caviar comes from? Answer. Sure, I know. Question. Triumphantly, as if he were about to shatter the witness in the eyes of the jury on account of his general ignorance and lack of knowledge of his trade. Well, where does it come from then? Well, with a slight leer, why, from whitefish, of course. Here again, here's a little humor, here's logic. Who's buried in Grant's tomb? And so, you know, the logic that comes from it. Well, where does whitefish come from? See, that question, when it was asked, was improper. He should have said, can you tell us the difference between whitefish caviar and sturgeon caviar? He didn't. Well, do you even know where whitefish comes from? See, that doesn't leave, well, it does leave, it leaves the witness with an opportunity to throw a little humor at you at the ignorance of your question. But it doesn't go to the knowledge of the merchant, which is really what we're trying to test. And so he asked a question improperly, and he got a proper answer. Where does whitefish caviar come from? Well, it comes from whitefish. Where does bluefish caviar come from? Well, it comes from bluefish. Are we trying to figure out what color these fish are that lay the eggs? Or are we trying to figure out, well, what's the difference in the quality? And why is it that the sturgeon caviar sells for four times as much as whitefish caviar? Well, is it caviar or is it fish eggs? Is there a difference between fish eggs and caviar? And that's what we're trying to get at. So sometimes, you know, people leave themselves open and vulnerable. Now, here's a neat story. It has to do with J.W. Donovan. He's the author of The Modern Jury Trial. And he quotes the Brooklyn Eagles account of a trial conducted by Charles Spencer, Charles Spencer, against the late Edwin James as opposing counsel involving a soldier's claim for $1,800, money loaned to a friend after the Civil War. Now keep in mind, $1,800 is an awful lot of money after the Civil War. I mean, $1,800 today, you know, is chicken feed, but $1,800 back in those days was a bundle of money. So, question, you loaned him $1,800. Answer, I did, sir. Question, when, sir? In 1866. Then where did you get the money? Answer, I earned it, sir. And a very meek tone of voice. Question, when did you earn it? Answer, during the war, sir, meekly. Question, what was your occupation during the war? Answer, modestly, fighting, sir. Now, up to this time, the issue had been much in doubt, but now the jury plainly leaned to the side of the soldier. Colonel Spencer, sensing this, closed the evidence as quickly as possible. Then he summed up to the jury, and he told a story about the soldier who had guarded our liberties and helped to save our nation, who risked his life, and as a result, he won the verdict. Now, commenting upon the case the same day, Mr. James said to Colonel Spencer, "That war speech of yours did it, and it was all the fault of my cross-examination. Otherwise, you would have known nothing about his war record." "Ah," said Spencer, "the mistake that you made was that you didn't find out that my client was a Confederate soldier, or you could have changed the whole verdict yourself." So here he is in New York City. A Confederate soldier lent money to a Yankee. The Yankee didn't pay him back. Now the bias and the prejudice of the New York jury would have probably given the verdict to the Yankee. As we discuss a little later, you know, when we talk about, we did this earlier when we talked about the case of the counting of the votes. So when you have a prejudice that's built in, or if you're doing an examination and you don't go far enough, and that's what happened in this case here. He opened it up. "Oh, you're a veteran. Well, where did you get the money?" "Well, I got it in the war." "Well, what were you doing in the war?" "Well, I was fighting, sir." He didn't go far enough. He didn't get the answer. And I told you about this guy, Stephen Beer. You know, he's asking me questions, and he said, "Well, do you own the house at 4421 Denton Street?" And I said, "Yes." "No, I don't." And I answered it, no, I don't own that house. Then he came back and he said, well, how do you explain your name being on the assessor's rolls at 4421 Denton Street? And I said, I don't. And he said, may I remind you that you're testifying under the penalty of perjury? And I said, thank you. And he said, do you deny that you own the house at 4421 Denton Street? And I said, no. He said, well, then do you admit that you own the house at 4421 Denton Street? And I said, no. And then he reminded me again, may I remind you that you're testifying under penalty of perjury? And I said, thank you again. Now think about that. Am I lying or am I telling the truth? The truth of the matter is, I'm not telling him anything. I didn't lie to him. I answered all of his questions. He never asked the right question. So I gave him the wrong answer, or I gave him the correct answer to his wrong question, or I gave him the wrong answer to his correct question. However you want to phrase it, however you want to word it, if you can't ask the right question, you cannot get the correct answer. So tuck that one away in your heart. If you can't ask the right question, you can't get the right answer. Now, the best guy, in my experience, the best guy to be asking these questions is the guy who is either the plaintiff or the defendant. And why is that? It's because he's the guy that was actually there. He's the guy that actually knows who's lying and who's telling the truth. When that cop gets on the witness stand and he lies, you know it. But your defense attorney doesn't know that. Your attorney only knows what you told him. And then when your attorney comes in and he hears the other side, the other story, immediately he believes that story. It's just human nature. And he disbelieves you. And so now this puts him at a psychological disadvantage. So always tuck it away in your heart. The guy that knows the case the best is you. And you will actually make the best cross-examiner. But unfortunately, what happens in the real world is we're timid, we're scared, and we say, oh my God, I've got to have a good lawyer. So you go out and you hire a lawyer. And this lawyer, he may be good, he may be bad. He's not necessarily all that bad, but he's working at a disadvantage because all he knows is what you tell him, and he can't get the whole story from you. In addition to that, he may not have all of the skills that an F. Lee Bailey has. So if we could teach you these skills, you're the best possible advocate for your side. There isn't anybody better than you. So if you want to learn how to do it, give me a call here at the law school, and let's teach you how the 28 elements of courtroom strategy and procedure can be made to work for you. All right, we will finish this up next time. Let me give you a final reminder here that you have been listening to the Law Hour and Editorial Review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. We're heard worldwide over the Internet daily. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. If you'd like more information, please go to our homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Your time's up. We've got to leave it right there, so we'll see you back here tomorrow night, same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night, friends.